5. Phone booth. Jack parked the VW in front of the Rexall in the Table Mesa shopping center and let the engine die. He wondered again if he shouldn't go ahead and get the fuel pump replaced, and told himself again that they couldn't afford it. If the little car could keep running until November, it could retire with full honors anyway. By November, the snow up there in the mountains would be higher than the Beetle's roof, maybe higher than 3 Beetles stacked on top of each other. "Want you to stay in this car, Doc. I'll bring you a candy bar." "Why can't I come in? I have to make a phone call. It's private stuff." "Is that why you didn't make it at home?" "Check." Wendy had insisted on a phone in spite of their unraveling finances. She had argued that with a small child, especially a boy like Danny, who sometimes suffered from fainting spells, they couldn't afford not to have one. So Jack had forked over the $30 installation fee, bad enough, and a $90 security deposit, which really hurt. And so far the phone had been mute, except for 2 wrong numbers.
"Can I have a baby Ruth, Daddy?"
"Yes. You sit still and don't play with the gear shift, right?"
"Right. I'll look at the maps."
"You do that." As Jack got out, Danny opened the Bug's glove box and took out the 5 battered gas station maps. Colorado, Nebraska, Utah, Wyoming, New Mexico. He loved road maps, loved to trace where the roads went with his finger. As far as he was concerned, new maps were the best part of moving west. Jack went to the drugstore counter, got Danny's candy bar, a newspaper, and a copy of the October Writer's Digest. He gave the girl a 5 and asked for his change in quarters. With the silver in his hand, he walked over to the telephone booth by the key-making machine and slipped inside. From here, he could see Danny and the Bug through 3 sets of glass. The boy's head was bent studiously over his maps. Jack felt a wave of nearly desperate love for the boy. The emotion showed on his face as a stony grimness. He supposed he could have made his obligatory thank you call to Al from home. He certainly wasn't going to say anything Wendy would object to. It was his pride that said no. These days, he almost always listened to what his pride told him to do, because along with his wife and son, $600 in a checking account, and 1 weary 1968 Volkswagen, his pride was all that was left, the only thing that was his. Even the checking account was joint. A year ago, he had been teaching English in one of the finest prep schools in New England. There had been friends, although not exactly the same ones he'd had before going on the wagon. Some laughs, fellow faculty members who admired his deft touch in the classroom and his private dedication to writing. Things had been very good 6 months ago. All at once, there was enough money left over at the end of each 2-week pay period to start a little savings account. In his drinking days, there had never been a penny left over, even though Al Shockley had stood a great many of the rounds. He and Wendy had begun to talk cautiously about finding a house and making a down payment in a year or so. A farmhouse in the country. Take 6 or 8 years to renovate it completely. What the hell, they were young. They had time. Then he had lost his temper. George Hatfield. The smell of hope had turned to the smell of old leather in Cromert's office. The whole thing like some scene from his own play. The old prints of previous Stovington headmasters on the walls. Steel engravings of the school as it had been in 1879 when it was first built, and in 1895, when Vanderbilt money had enabled them to build the field house that still stood at the west end of the soccer field, squat, immense, dressed in ivy. April ivy had been rustling outside Cromert's slit window, and the drowsy sound of steam heat came from the radiator. It was no set, he remembered thinking. It was real. His life. How could he have fucked it up so badly?
"This is a serious situation, Jack. Terribly serious. The board has asked me to convey its decision to you."
The board wanted Jack's resignation, and Jack had given it to them. Under different circumstances, he would have gotten tenure that June. What had followed that interview in Cromert's office had been the darkest, most dreadful night of his life. The wanting, the needing to get drunk had never been so bad. His hand shook. He knocked things over, and he kept wanting to take it out on Wendy and Danny. His temper was like a vicious animal on a frayed leash. He had left the house in terror that he might strike them, had ended up outside a bar, and the only thing that had kept him from going in was the knowledge that if he did, Wendy would leave him at last, and take Danny with her. He would be dead from the day they left. Instead of going into the bar where Dark Shadow sat sampling the tasty waters of oblivion, he had gone to Al Shockley's house. The board's vote had been 6-1. Al had been the one. Now he dialed the operator, and she told him that for $1.85 he could be put in touch with Al 2,000 miles away for 3 minutes. Time is relative, baby, he thought, and stuck in 8 quarters. Faintly he could hear the electronic boops and beeps of his connection sniffing its way eastward. Al's father had been Arthur Longley Shockley, the Steel Baron. He had left his only son, Albert, a fortune, and a huge range of investments and directorships and chairs on various boards. One of these had been on the board of directors for Stovington Preparatory Academy, the old man's favorite charity. Both Arthur and Albert Shockley were alumni, and Al lived in Barrie, close enough to take a personal interest in the school's affairs. For several years, Al had been Stovington's tennis coach. Jack and Al had become friends in a completely natural and uncoincidental way. At the many school and faculty functions they attended together, they were always the two drunkest people there. Shockley was separated from his wife, and Jack's own marriage was skidding slowly downhill, although he still loved Wendy and had promised sincerely and frequently to reform, for her sake and for baby Danny's. The two of them went on from many faculty parties, hitting the bars until they closed, then stopping at some mom-and-pop store for a case of beer they would drink parked at the end of some back road. There were mornings when Jack would stumble into their leased house with dawn seeping into the sky and find Wendy and the baby asleep on the couch, Danny always on the inside, a tiny fist curled under the shelf of Wendy's jaw. He would look at them and the self-loathing would back up in his throat in a bitter wave, even stronger than the taste of beer and cigarettes and martinis. Martians, as Al called them. Those were the times that his mind would turn thoughtfully and sanely to the gun, or the rope, or the razor blade. If the bender had occurred on a weeknight, he would sleep for 3 hours, get up, dress, chew 4 Excedrins, and go off to teach his 9 o'clock American poets, still drunk. Good morning, kids. Today the red-eyed wonder is going to tell you about how Longfellow lost his wife in the big fire. He hadn't believed he was an alcoholic, Jack thought, as Al's telephone began ringing in his ear. The classes he had missed or taught unshaven, still reeking of last night's Martians. Not me. I can stop any time. The nights he and Wendy had passed in separate beds. Listen, I'm fine. Mashed fenders. Sure, I'm okay to drive. The tears she always shed in the bathroom. Cautious looks from his colleagues at any party where alcohol was served, even wine. The slowly dawning realization that he was being talked about. The knowledge that he was producing nothing at his Underwood but balls of mostly blank paper that ended up in the wastebasket. He had been something of a catch for Stovington, a slowly blooming American writer, perhaps, and certainly a man well qualified to teach that great mystery, creative writing. He had published 2 dozen short stories. He was working on a play and thought there might be a novel incubating in some mental back room. But now he was not producing, and his teaching had become erratic. It had finally ended one night less than a month after Jack had broken his son's arm. That, it seemed to him, had ended his marriage. All that remained was for Wendy to gather her will. If her mother hadn't been such a grade-A bitch, he knew, Wendy would have taken a bus back to New Hampshire as soon as Danny had been okay to travel. It was over. It had been a little past midnight. Jack and Al were coming into Barrie on U.S. 31, Al behind the wheel of his Jag, shifting fancily on the curves, sometimes crossing the double yellow line. They were both very drunk. The Martians had landed that night in force. They came around the last curve before the bridge at 70, and there was a kid's bike in the road, and then the sharp, hurt squealing as rubber shredded from the Jag's tires, and Jack remembered seeing Al's face looming over the steering wheel like a round, white moon. Then the jingling, crashing sound as they hit the bike at 40, and it had flown up like a bent and twisted bird, the handlebars striking the windshield, and then it was in the air again, leaving the starred safety glass in front of Jack's bulging eyes. A moment later he heard the final dreadful smash as it landed on the road behind them. Something thumped underneath them as the tires passed over it. The Jag drifted around broadside, Al still jockeying the wheel, and from far away Jack heard himself saying, "Jesus, Al! We ran him down, I felt it!" In his ear, the phone kept ringing. "Come on, Al, be home. Let me get this over with." Al had brought the car to a smoking halt, not more than 3 feet from a bridge stanchion. Two of the Jag's tires were flat. They had left zigzagging loops of burned rubber for 130 feet. They looked at each other for a moment, and then ran back in the cold darkness. The bike was completely ruined. One wheel was gone, and looking back over his shoulder, Al had seen it lying in the middle of the road, half a dozen spokes sticking up like piano wire. Al had said hesitantly, "I think that's what we ran over, Jackie boy." "Then where's the kid?" "Did you see a kid?" Jack frowned. It had all happened with such crazy speed. Coming around the corner, the bike looming in the Jag's headlights, Al yelling something, then the collision and the long skid. They moved the bike to one shoulder of the road. Al went back to the Jag and put on its four-way flashers. For the next 2 hours, they searched the sides of the road, using a powerful four-cell flashlight. Nothing. Although it was late, several cars passed the beached Jaguar and the two men with the bobbing flashlight. None of them stopped. Jack thought later that some queer providence, bent on giving them both a last chance, had kept the cops away, had kept any of the passers-by from calling them. At 2:15, they returned to the Jag, sober but queasy.
"If there was nobody riding it, what was it doing in the middle of the road?" Al demanded. "It wasn't parked on the side, it was right in the fucking middle."
Jack could only shake his head. "Your party does not answer," the operator said. "Would you like me to keep on trying?" "A couple more rings, operator. Do you mind?" "No, sir," the voice said dutifully. "Come on, Al."
Al had hiked across the bridge to the nearest payphone, called a bachelor friend, and told him it would be worth $50 if the friend would get the Jag snow tires out of the garage and bring them down to the Highway 31 bridge outside of Barrie. The friend showed up 20 minutes later, wearing a pair of jeans and his pajama top. He surveyed the scene.
"Kill anybody?" he asked.
Al was already jacking up the back of the car, and Jack was loosening lug nuts.
"Providentially, no one," Al said.
"I think I'll just head on back anyway. Pay me in the morning."
"Fine,"
Al said without looking up. The two of them had gotten the tires on without incident, and together they drove back to Al Shockley's house. Al put the Jag in the garage and killed the motor. In the dark quiet, he said,
"I'm off drinking, Jackie boy. It's all over. I've slain my last Martian."
And now, sweating in this phone booth, it occurred to Jack that he had never doubted Al's ability to carry through. He had driven back to his own house in the VW, with the radio turned up, and some disco group chanted over and over again, "Talismanic" in the house before dawn.
"Do it anyway. You want to do it. Do it any way you want."
No matter how loud, he heard the squealing tires, the crash. When he blinked his eyes shut, he saw that single crushed wheel with its broken spokes pointing at the sky. When he got in, Wendy was asleep on the couch. He looked in Danny's room and Danny was in his crib on his back, sleeping deeply, his arms still buried in the cast. In the softly filtered glow from the streetlight outside, he could see the dark lines on its plastered whiteness where all the doctors and nurses and pediatrics had signed it.
"It was an accident. He fell down the stairs. Oh, you dirty liar. It was an accident. I lost my temper. You fucking drunken waste. God wiped snot out of his nose and that was you. Listen, hey, come on, please, just an accident."
But the last plea was driven away by the image of that bobbing flashlight as they hunted through the dry late November weeds, looking for the sprawled body that by all good rights should have been there, waiting for the police. It didn't matter that Al had been driving. There had been other nights when he had been driving. He pulled the covers up over Danny, went into their bedroom, and took the Spanish Llama 38 down from the top shelf of the closet. It was in a shoebox. He sat on the bed with it for nearly an hour, looking at it, fascinated by its deadly shine. It was dawn when he put it back in the box and put the box back in the closet. That morning he had called Bruckner, the department head, and told him to please post his classes. He had the flu. Bruckner agreed, with less good grace than was common. Jack Torrance had been extremely susceptible to the flu in the last year. Wendy made him scrambled eggs and coffee. They ate in silence. The only sound came from the backyard, where Danny was gleefully running his trucks across the sand pile with his good hand. She went to do the dishes. Her back to him, she said, "Jack, I've been thinking."
"Have you?"
He lit a cigarette with trembling hands. No hangover this morning, oddly enough. Only the shakes. He blinked. In the instant's darkness, the bike flew up against the windshield, starring the glass. The tires shrieked. The flashlight bobbed.
"I want to talk to you about what's best for me and Danny.
For you too, maybe. I don't know. We should have talked about it before, I guess." "Would you do something for me?" he asked, looking at the wavering tip of his cigarette. "Would you do me a favor?"
"What?"
Her voice was dull and neutral. He looked at her back.
"Let's talk about it a week from today, if you still want to."
Now she turned to him, her hands lacy with suds, her pretty face pale and disillusioned.
"Jack, promises don't work with you. You just go right on with—"
She stopped, looking in his eyes, fascinated, suddenly uncertain.
"In a week," he said.
His voice had lost all its strength and dropped to a whisper.
"Please, I'm not promising anything. If you still want to talk, then we'll talk about anything you want."
They looked across the sunny kitchen at each other for a long time, and when she turned back to the dishes without saying anything more, he began to shudder.
God, he needed a drink. Just a little pick-me-up to put things in their true perspective.
"Danny said he dreamed you had a car accident," she said abruptly. "He has funny dreams sometimes. He said it this morning when I got him dressed."
"Did you, Jack? Did you have an accident?"
"No." By noon, the craving for a drink had become a low-grade fever. He went to Al's.
"You dry?"
Al asked before letting him in. Al looked horrible.
"Bone dry. You look like Lon Chaney in Phantom of the Opera. Come on in."
They played two-handed whist all afternoon. They didn't drink. A week passed. He and Wendy didn't speak much, but he knew she was watching, not believing. He drank coffee black and endless cans of Coca-Cola. One night he drank a whole six-pack of Coke and then ran into the bathroom and vomited it up. The level of the bottles in the liquor cabinet did not go down. After his classes, he went over to Al Shockley's. She hated Al Shockley worse than she had ever hated anyone. And when he came home, she would swear she smelled scotch or gin on his breath, but he would talk lucidly to her before supper, drink coffee, play with Danny after supper, sharing a Coke with him, read him a bedtime story, then sit and correct themes with cup after cup of black coffee by his hand, and she would have to admit to herself that she had been wrong. Weeks passed, and the unspoken word retreated further from the back of her lips. Jack sensed its retirement, but knew it would never retire completely. Things began to get a little easier. Then, George Hatfield. He had lost his temper again. This time, stone sober.
"Sir, your party still doesn't—"
"Hello?" Al's voice, out of breath.
"Go ahead," the operator said dourly.
"Al, this is Jack Torrance."
"Jackie boy!"
Genuine pleasure.
"How are you?"
"Good. I just called to say thanks. I got the job. It's perfect. If I can't finish that goddamn place snowed in all winter, I'll never finish it."
"You'll finish."
"How are things?" Jack asked hesitantly.
"Dry,"
Al responded.
"You?"
"As a bone."
"Miss it much?"
"Every day." Al laughed.
"I know that scene. But I don't know how you stayed dry after that Hatfield thing, Jack. That was above and beyond."
"I really bitched things up for myself," he said evenly.
"Oh, hell, I'll have the board around by spring. Effinger's already saying they might have been too hasty. And if that play comes to something—"
"Yes, listen, my boy's out in the car, Al. He looks like he might be getting restless."
"Sure, understand. You have a good winter up there, Jack. Glad to help."
"Thanks again, Al." He hung up, closed his eyes in the hot booth, and again saw the crashing bike, the bobbing flashlight. There had been a squib in the paper the next day, no more than a space filler, really, but the owner had not been named. Why it had been out there in the night would always be a mystery to them, and perhaps that was as it should be. He went back out to the car and gave Danny his slightly melted baby Ruth.
Daddy?
What, Doc? Danny hesitated, looking at his father's abstracted face.
When I was waiting for you to come back from that hotel, I had a bad dream, do you remember? When I fell asleep?
Mm-hmm. But it was no good. Daddy's mind was someplace else, not with him, thinking about the bad thing again.
I dreamed that you hurt me, Daddy.
What was the dream, Doc?
Nothing, Danny said as they pulled out into the parking lot.
He put the maps back into the glove compartment.
You sure?
Yes. Jack gave his son a faint, troubled glance, and then his mind turned to his play.